and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. Thanks for listening. Tonight I have with us my friend and my lecture partner, Cynthia Sue Larson, and we're going to talk about her new book, among other things, Reality Shifts, When Consciousness Changes in Physical Reality, in the physical world. So how are you, Cynthia Sue?
I'm terrific. Good to
Thanks
be
for
here.
Taking the time to come on tonight. I really do appreciate it. I know my listeners will. So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, how you came to do what you do, and where people can find you.
Okay. Well, my background, originally I got a degree in physics from UC Berkeley, and then thanks to a number of experiences, including a Kundalini awakening, got very interested in observing changes to reality that accompanied just changes in consciousness. In other words, I was literally seeing reality changing as a result of states of consciousness that I was in. My website is realityshifters.com, and that's the best way to find me. That's where I publish a newsletter, got lots of articles, and it describes the books that I've written, and also a meditation CD.
So what brought you to write this book? What is it about?
Okay, this is a book that basically covers a number of experiences that I've had as well as people close to me have had. And what I call a reality shift is really changes in things that we observe appearing, disappearing, transforming, transporting, and also changes in the experience of time. And I was witnessing lots of these things happening and didn't know what was going on, so I was looking it up, and I didn't see anything much written about it. This goes back to, like, the early 1990s, mid-1990s. And so my website started in 1998, 99, and the book Reality Shift is finally out in paperback after a number of years of collecting stories, doing research, and just really finding out from people around the world that this is not that uncommon a phenomenon. It's not just a simple matter of being forgetful or spacing out, but actually when we put things down, sometimes we come back and things are not where we thought we put them. They really can move around, they can completely vanish, and they can come back. And the reason I think it's so important for people to be aware of this phenomenon is that it changes the quality of your life when you realize that being relaxed and grounded can make a positive difference. When you're a high-energy kind of person, you're less likely to blow out light bulbs, you know, when you walk into a room or have equipment malfunction, that kind of thing.
That's a good point. Me and some people that I know, it's not all the time, but sometimes. And it's not at home, so it was usually when I was working. Maybe it has to do with a conditioned space or something, I don't know, or unconditioned space. But my computers just do everything wrong. What makes that happen?
In general or in you in particular? It can depend on different people.
With people and their energy fields. I don't really know the appropriate question. Would it be different for me or someone else, or is there some...
There are some people that just seem to delight in the fact that they would crash systems. That's what was said about Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist, who I don't know how true it is that he was kind of proud of his reputation, but anywhere that he went, it seemed there was this sort of a Pauli effect that would follow him around. And that was something, you know, that he in particular felt, I guess, a little bit of pride in. But most people are not that happy because there are so many technological places and things going on now that we can't really afford to have that kind of a Pauli effect or crash the computer's effect. Because everywhere we go, there are computers or there's some kind of electronic equipment of a sensitive nature that we don't want to be messing with. And so the way you'd know that you have this problem, you'd know it pretty quick because you'd notice if you're in a bad mood or if you're feeling a tremendous amount of anxiety or angst. That's what I mean by ungrounded and highly energized. And then you interact with your computer or your phone or whatever device it is, maybe a GPS device, maybe your car. Could be almost anything. But if you're noticing that your equipment and devices are going on the fritz quite a lot, and it seems, I just like people to pay attention to the fact of your mood and your state of mind. And so being calm, relaxed, makes a big difference. That's what I mean by grounding. And if you can, it's okay to be high energy if you are grounded. But most people, I think what happens is you can get kind of anxious. Like if you're late or if you're running late and you're going somewhere and you're trying to phone someone and then your phone doesn't work. I think that's happened to most of us. What you can try is just calm yourself down, breathe slowly and deeply, count to 10, whatever it is that you can do to really relax and get grounded, and then try it again. And this is the same kind of thing that can work if a computer is messing up or having problems or having difficulties, whether it's with your computer or the internet, what have you. So what's happening, best I can describe it, it's you can think of it like very out-of-sync waveforms that are causing a very destructive level of interference rather than constructive interference. So if you can think of like waves on the ocean and they get, the waves get really choppy, that's not the kind of water that you'd want to take your boat out onto because you can get pretty seasick. But that is the kind of energy that we send out when we're kind of in a consternated, frantic, anxious, worried, or angry kind of state of mind.
That makes so much sense. Okay, there are some other things. Oh, I know that there's, you and I talked a few weeks ago. Do you care if we talk on some topics that's outside this book?
Oh, yeah. You mean
is that okay?
Oh, yeah, it's fine to talk about lots of things, anything.
I know there's some new science out that people would find really interesting, like the diamonds. And I know there's some more than that. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Okay.
I want people to understand, you know, you're not just saying words, meditation does good, grounding does you good. I want them to get that there's a reason why it really works. And it's not just the mystics saying it anymore. It's science saying that reality, you can change your life with thought. How do we know that's real?
Well, it's something that it's hard to prove, you know, to draw that connection between ourselves and then physics, because people are very involved beings. And so physics is one way to look at the nature of reality. But reality itself is something that many of our assumptions have been a little bit off about. And that's what I think is so brilliant about quantum physics. And the new science you're referring to is the science that's showing us that things that were happening that we thought at one point was only happening on the quantum scale. And that the quantum scale has some strange behavior. Everything exists in a superposition of states, essentially. So people have heard about Schrodinger's cat and the way that you can tell probabilistically whether something, the cat, is, you know, whether it's alive or dead when it's placed in a box where there may or may not have been poison that may or may not have, you know, killed the cat. That's just one example that people tend to remember. But basically, on the quantum realm, there are many things going on that scientists in general had not expected to ever see on what we call the macroscopic scale. We did not expect to see, for example, quantum particles blipping into and out of existence, yet they have been observed. It is an observable phenomena. We did not expect to see that we would recognize quantum entanglement, where a couple of particles would be interacting simultaneously. You know, that's something that happens on the quantum scale. It's what Einstein referred to as spooky action at a distance when he heard about it. And so that very strange behavior that quantum particles can do with, whether it's entanglement, quantum teleportation, quantum tunneling, all these things, have not typically been recognized as occurring on a level that would affect a human being, for example. But that is changing, and it's changing just in the last few years. What's happening, it's been a small trickle of studies at first, and it's turning into, I think, a floodgate is opening, where we are seeing the entire realm of quantum biology opening up, and there are studies happening. You mentioned one of them with the diamonds. That's an experiment that's been happening at the Clarendon Laboratory at the University of Oxford over in England. And what's happening there is that two physically separated diamonds, now these are diamonds that you could hold in your hand, and you could look at them. They're pretty tiny, but you could definitely see I'm holding a diamond. And so these are, you can hold them in your hand, you can feel them, you can touch them, you can see them. And these scientists separated those diamonds and would zap one of them with an ultra-short laser, which set it to vibrating. Kind of like if you hit a tuning fork, it starts resonating and making a sound. And just like a tuning fork, you'd expect that there would be a resonant effect, you know, with another tuning fork. Okay, that's the tuning fork example. But that's very different than what we see with entangled items. The strange thing here is that when one diamond was zapped with a laser over in England, then the other diamond, separated just a couple meters, a few meters away, at room temperature, also started showing signs that it had been zapped by a laser. In other words, we're getting instantaneous effect between two physically separated objects that had been entangled together. Now, what you may wonder, why is this going on? Why is the sudden interest in quantum physics, you know, bringing things up to that macroscopic scale? A lot of it has to do with the interest in developing quantum computers. So you're going to see increasing amounts of activity with people bringing these quantum effects into the macroscopic scale. That's the interest that I have in this, is that for so many years I've heard people say, well, it's impossible for something to appear, disappear, transform, or transport, or for there to be changes in time. But now we're reaching the point where we do expect to see these things. We're going to increasingly expect to see it. It's going to become scientifically verifiable, and these experiments are reproducible. So it's the kind of thing that you're going to get more and more of that type of activity going on.
So I'm curious, would it make any difference what size the diamonds were? I mean, could it be as big as a house if they could vibrate it? Make it vibrate, or does size make any difference to make?
You're dealing with an engineering question right now, and right now these diamonds are pretty tiny. I think it. So most of the effects that we're seeing are still just groups of molecules. They're very tiny diamonds. Things haven't gotten to a very large scale, but there's no reason why they can't. It's just a matter of, like I said, engineering. Mm-hmm. So we've cleared the first hurdle of, these things are impossible to ever witness or see on the human level. That's no longer true. We're also noticing that just the closer we look at the field of biology, it's most likely the case that everything, including plants and animals and ourselves, all of our bodies and all the plants are using these same effects of quantum entanglement, quantum superposition, in order to function properly. Our very sense of smell depends upon quantum tunneling, most likely.
What is quantum tunneling?
Okay, that would be where you're able to... let's just start with the example of smelling something with your nose. And imagine that when you're smelling something, there's a receptor in your nose that needs to match up to with the molecule of whatever fragrance or smell is being received. And so... usually, it was assumed that when we're smelling something and it's like one part in 10 million or something, pretty dilute fragrance, then it would be difficult for a person to smell something, but not impossible. And then as it gets further diluted, we'd expect that people wouldn't usually smell something when it's pretty much gone. But the truth is that people can smell things even when they are diluted way, 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 way down. And this reminds me a little bit of that kind of medicine that's based on, you know, I forget what it's called now, but It's like the Bach flower remedies, homeopathics, you know, where you just take a little bit of something and it has a big effect. Well, something like that is going on with our noses because, strangely, even though we don't have a smell receptor for every kind of molecule, against all odds, we might have just a little teeny tiny fragrance of something that smells a bit like rotten eggs, for example. And even though one part of our nose doesn't have a receptor right there, somehow, miraculously, that little particle of rotten egg smell matches up exactly to one of our nose receptors. And it happens way more than it should probabilistically. Okay, so what's going on? It seems, and it's not proven yet, but there's a very strong theory that seems to be gaining ground as we speak, and that is that a quantum tunneling kind of effect is occurring, where if you need to have that kind of a smell receptor and you need that particle to be received by a smell receptor, then across all probabilities, if you think just as human beings are like quantum particles, we exist in a superposition of all states, then some version of us with the smell receptor in the right place is there to receive that exact little bit of rotten egg smell. And I know that just sounds far-fetched, and how is that possible? But quantum tunneling, the way we observe it is, we'll see something, little quantum particle coming up to a physical barrier, and then, bloop, it's on the other side. And the analogy with our nose is that that little smell of, you know, that little piece of rotten egg smell is coming in, and then, bloop, it arrives just where we would want it to be so we could smell it with our smell receptor.
That's amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So let's talk about consciousness. What is that thing to you?
That's a really big question, yeah. Well, it's much more than just our brains. I'll tell you that to get started, because some people seem to have a reductionistic idea of consciousness, and that doesn't match my experience at all. It's not the case that I haven't been in a coma. Some people have, and you know, that's a very compelling story when their brain is physically dead and they're still able to think. I've heard about those stories. But just for myself, I've been able to recognize many times when it just seems like there's no way that I could know things that I know. There's no way that I could be in a place that I need to be. However, simply by meditating and by bringing my consciousness, what I would call up, to a level of love and unconditional, agape, loving kindness and compassion, that is where amazing things happen, and I can feel a sense of inspiration. So I'm speaking experientially for myself. To me, consciousness is that part of myself and others that has knowledge that exists seemingly alongside space and time, but sometimes almost in an independent fashion, that it stands alone. You know, you could talk about space-time, and then you could have consciousness right alongside that. So it's a big question and not easy to define.
So what is mind?
To me, mind is, it's not brain either. Like, brain is kind of like the little physical computer. Mind would be something akin to kind of like when you've got your computer that you can hook it up to the internet, then an analogy would be the mind is operating our brains and our bodies, but it's connected to us, but not physically. It's very much not just the brain. And consciousness to me is a sense of being connected with others, with oneself, being aware. And so for me, the consciousness part of it is the ability to interact and to have things seem to make sense and to, like I said, to be connected to knowledge. The mind is the tool that allows us to do that, but again, it's not the brain. The brain is just something, it's a lesser thing than the mind.
So what is the, let me rephrase that question, so like I'm giving a deposition here. Is there a difference between big mind and little mind, and what are those things, and what's the importance of understanding if there is? That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I think when I think little mind, I'd be thinking of kind of just our day-to-day concerns and our animal worries for our safety and ourselves, and what you might call the ego sense of self. The part of us that is concerned about survival, that is very defensive. And I think the big mind rises above that, has a bigger view of things. In the realm of consciousness, this would be the part of knowledge and awareness that knows intrinsically that before we were born, we came from somewhere. We already did exist in some shape. And so there's a confidence and there's an easy sense of grace and fearlessness in the big mind. And the big mind knows that we're all as one. The big mind knows that when we're dreaming, sometimes that's more real than the so-called reality. The big mind understands that the way that we can relax, calm ourselves, and feel love and connection and compassion totally changes everything. So that big mind consciousness is, to me, it's something that we're capable of attaining. However, it seems to require a great deal of attention through either meditation and or prayer. It can be triggered through some kind of a special experience, like near-death experience, or some kind of a trauma or, you know, peak experience also.
So from a science perspective, from a physicist perspective, what happens when you die?
Well,
you can. I know language is going to be a problem, but...
And once again, you've got different kinds of scientists' viewpoints here, because some scientists have had the experience that they have died and they've come back. They will tell you something very different than those who have not. And so I would tend to want to hear from those scientists who have died and come back, like Eben Alexander, for example, the neuroscientist. Love his experience, love his story. So those are the kind of scientists that I would want to listen to, because to me, they have had that experience of big mind. And then you'll hear from scientists who have not had that experience, and it's not that they, they just don't know. It's not so much that they're missing something or that they're not less intelligent, but frankly, if you haven't experienced something like big mind, then it's just a bit much it's more than we can properly describe, because it's so much beyond the realm of our senses, which are naturally very limited. I mean, we know that we can only see certain frequencies of color and light. We know that we don't see everything, like the infrared, the ultraviolet, that's beyond human vision. We're very limited, just red through violet, and if you look at the spectrum, it's very tiny. So scientists who can just think for a moment and realize, okay, there may be something more than I've ever experienced, they would have an open mind to this. And so those scientists who have experienced what it's like beyond death, they will tell you, like even Alexander does, and I just love his story about it, that you can get to a place that feels just amazing. Like, it feels so far beyond anything that you feel in ordinary life. It's just like you're waking up for the first time, like you're seeing colors that you didn't know existed, like you're feeling so much more compassion and caring from the beings that you experience there, that it's, man, it makes you miss it when you go away. So
what? And for me right now, language is a problem. What do you think? What is it that leaves? I mean, your body. When you die, obviously your body falls down and it doesn't work anymore. What is it that exists? Ether, frequencies. What is it? Do you know?
I don't know, but I could. I mean, it's just conjecture. With someone who's been in a coma, for example, then clearly their mind is operating, even though their brain may be physically dead or dying or just dysfunctional in many ways. And so that tells us right there that the mind is still operating. It's not the brain. The mind is more than the brain. The brain is like a tool. And the mind obviously can exist, that part of consciousness that, or we may or may not remember exactly who we are. If anybody's not read Proof of Heaven, I recommend it by Eben Alexander. But you know, I like that example because he actually did have brain death. It's not something where people can say, "Oh, he's dreaming; his brain is still working." He actually had meningitis, and his brain was being attacked, and his body was shutting down, and it was just a big mess. So when he made his journey, he didn't have a sense of identity. He kind of lost a sense of who he was. So that, it's a very interesting story there, because it shows that something's traveling. Even if we don't know who we are, we might be a little confused. We might, in other words, die suddenly. Maybe, you know, some people might be in a car accident and they didn't know they were about to die. And so they might make a sudden leap and may or may not remember who they are. But there's definitely going to be a continuation of their consciousness, of their mind. And I see so much evidence of this in people I love who've passed away as well. And I think most people who have lost loved ones, if you know what I'm talking about, if you love someone so much that you can barely tolerate the fact that they've died, and then even after they have died, you still feel connected, and amazing synchronicity occurs. You can still feel that when you ask a question or wish that they're there, you'll get a sign that they're with you, that only they would be able to give you. Like you might be thinking of them, and some quirky song that only they ever remind you of comes on the radio. Or maybe you'll see a white feather just fall out of the sky. Or, you know, just a number of things can happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do know. So let's move back to your book for just a minute. I want to talk about lucid dreaming for just a minute. My little boy, I have a 13-year-old little boy. And in the morning when I wake him up to go to school during school, well, any time of the year, but particularly in the morning, when I go to wake him up, he is not home. He gets very combative. He doesn't remember that we're there. His eyes, they can't see you. Even though his eyes are open and he sits up and he talks and says things, he's not home.
Right.
And the other day I said, he was saying something when I was trying to get him up. He was talking, but he was still sleeping. I said, "Buddy, Derek, where are you?" He said, "I'm jumping out of an airplane." So I went, "Oh my God, he's really somewhere else." So every day for about a week or two after that, I'd say, "Buddy," I'd go in there because it's summer, you know, and I can do this. And I said, "Where are you?" So the next day he said, "I'm at Walmart buying a football." So then the next day I said, "Where are you today?" And he said, "I'm rock climbing." The next day I said, "Where are you?" And he said, he was buying a motorcycle. And I mean, he was like, "Be quiet, Mom, I want to finish buying this motorcycle." Where is he?
That's amazing, because you wouldn't, I don't know if he's had experiences like doing that, but
I have not. I mean, I've had dreams before, usually nightmares, where I know that I'm in a nightmare and I'll get up and go to the bathroom and I come back and pick up where I left off. So I know that something's going on there, but I don't know what it is. Where is he going?
Well, that's
where
a great question.
Stopping
where do
and
we
rock
go when we dream?
And jumping out of airplanes.
Well, that's the fun thing. I think there's a real strong reason that we dream, and it enables us to get to a place very similar to the one I'm talking about, where we go when we die, and that would be giving us the opportunity to try things out. Like if you're 13, and I don't imagine that your son has jumped out of an airplane already, unless, you know, maybe he's watched movies about it. But anyway, you can try things in dreams that you've never been able to do up until that dream. You know, it's a great way to kind of skip around through space and time. And you mentioned lucid dreaming. That's a very special kind of dreaming, which I think is worth giving a moment to, because when people have a lucid dream, it really means that you know that you're awake in the dream. It's a very special kind of dreaming. And I'm not sure if Derek knows he's awake it sounds like he's kind of still in that dream, so it's almost like he's not sleepwalking, but kind of like he can talk and still be dreaming, and that's pretty cool. But lucid dreaming is the ability to know when you're in that dream, like, wow, you know, if you're having a bit of a nightmare and there's some sort of a scary person coming into the room, then you might remember, hey, I know I'm dreaming. I can just fly, you know, because in dreams I can fly. I can fly right past that person and go zooming out the window, you know, or whatever. whatever. So it's a fun way to gain experience in the world in ways that you might not otherwise be able to. And you can go through rules and try all different things, because everything is possible. So you can walk on water, you can see through walls, you can go to the bottom of the ocean, you can go straight through the earth. You can go visit people who are across the world from you and see how they're doing. And sometimes when people experience these lucid dreams, they'll wake up and keep a journal and write down what happened and check in with the people. For example, if they did go visit someone and ask, did you notice that I was there? And that's very interesting, because you can engage with people on a conscious, mindful level that's far outside the quote-unquote normal range of experience. But this is something open to people that meditate, that practice these things.
So where do you think Derek's going? What's the difference between dreaming and, I don't even know the words here, what is he doing?
Well, most of us are experiencing various forms of reality. You know, it seems like when you're dreaming, you're trying things out. And so in general, when we dream, it's giving our mind the ability to go outside of our usual linear sense of time and space, so that you can actually, I mean, it's possible for Derek to skip forward till he's old enough that he could buy a motorcycle. He might have been actually seeing the real time that he's going to be buying a motorcycle when he's much older. That's possible. And that's very interesting, because it helps explain when people have a sense of deja vu. For me, deja vu feels like, wow, I've been here before. And often, in fact, several times I've remembered, in fact, I had a dream that was exactly this. And so, like many months or years earlier, I will have dreamt about the thing that's actually happening right now. And it's kind of weird. It's like I never would have guessed this would be happening. You know, what a weird thing to dream about in advance.
So is he going to like a, or and I assume we're just speculating here, but when people do this, are they going to like a parallel reality or a different time and space? Or, I mean, because obviously he has not had these experiences in this physical life.
Right. Yeah, so, jumping out of I was going to ask you about that. So he hasn't been skydiving or...
No. Well,
not a special summer program.
We haven't even been to Walmart to buy a football.
Okay. And that would be the most likely thing. Yeah. So you could think of it, one possibility is that he is playing around with possible realities. You know, maybe you could also start asking him, how old are you? Which would be interesting.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, what month is it? You know, because you can start finding out what day and what time and where he is. He's jumping out of an airplane. Where is he? You know, how? What year is it?
He's not real patient when I do this inquiry.
I know, because it interrupts the flow of events. He doesn't want to answer boring questions like that.
He gets frustrated. So, all right, we have about 20 minutes. So I want to give you a chance to talk about what you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought up lucid dreaming, because to me, that's one of the most important things that we can experience in terms of finding out a little bit about the way that these reality shifts are occurring, the way that we can manage our mindfulness and start choosing the kind of realities we'd like to experience. So it's a lot like tuning in on a radio dial and deciding which stations you want to listen to, getting away from the noisy stations and the static and tuning in something that you'd like to listen to. So it really isn't that complicated. But it does require, when I talk about mindfulness, I'm talking about becoming aware of the kind of patterns that we often get into. So in my book, Reality Shifts, I help people understand that we can, by meditating and feeling more love and just paying attention to our breathing, we can connect to a higher sense of consciousness that enables us to experience just real synchronicity that's a lot of fun, and to find people and things. And this to make it real, I should describe it with some stories, because in my book I talk about things that are kind of weird, like seeing a dead cat be alive again, seeing a broken watch be fixed again, seeing a book change, you know, all these kind of things. And those are kind of fun things, and they're interesting, and they're pretty day-to-day, run-of-the-mill types of reality shifts that people do experience quite a lot. But the reason that people would, in my opinion, be most interested in this book and this idea is that we're able to literally make a change in our world, and we can jump to a reality that is more enjoyable and more positive for us by basically getting out of the fear patterns that we tend to get caught up in. And so quite a bit of the book, after going through lucid dreaming, addresses noticing the kind of thought patterns that we have in mind, and the way that we can have self-talk that can either be very positive or very negative, that takes us either upward or into some sort of a downward spiral. And this is just about the most important thing you can do for yourself, is to be paying attention to your pattern of self-talk and the thoughts and feelings that are going through you, and to learn to get out of a kind of a reactive state. And so the power of lucid dreaming, and the power that these young children have who are able to dream so beautifully, is that when we start thinking, okay, what if consciousness is really realizing that we're always dreaming? What then? You know, what if that's what consciousness is, that whatever we dream, there we are? What if that's the nature of reality as well? And it's just a bit slower in this waking life. But if we can realize that we're dreaming right now, it makes life a lot more fun, because it opens up the possibility that you can start getting yourself into a good mood and being happy no matter what. You know, it doesn't really matter what the circumstances are. It doesn't matter if you're having troubles at work, with your marriage, with your family. It doesn't matter if you're losing your house and you have to move. You can still decide, I am going to be happy right now. I'm choosing that. And that is a huge change right there. You know, it requires a certain amount of mindfulness to enable yourself to go there. And there's a lot of science about this, too. In my book, Reality Shift, I cover quite a bit of it. Just the fact that when you make small changes in the way you're feeling, you're going to make big changes in your life. And that's basically the crux of everything that I write about. And I've been doing surveys, yeah, too, with people, where I'm seeing some interesting changes happening.
Tell us about the science. You know me, I love science.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to something simple, like smiling, for example, people often think that, like, if you're already in a bad mood, you can't just smile and bring yourself to a good mood. That does not, in fact, match the scientific evidence. What is true is that even if you just put a pencil in your mouth or a pen, something like that, which automatically starts changing your facial muscles, so even if you think, I can't smile, you just put a pencil or a pen in your mouth, and that will start working the musculature in your face. And it definitely has scientifically been proven, these are psychology studies, to change the mood of the participants in these studies, to the point where if they'd been watching a TV cartoon, which was supposed to be funny, if they were in that kind of a blah mood, you know, just feeling however they normally feel, and they don't put the pen or pencil in their mouth, then they don't find these things very funny. But if they put the pencil or pen in their mouth, which engages those smile muscles a bit, there's a huge statistically significant jump to where they start finding things much funnier. And so and this is just one of many, many, many studies on the subject. In many forms of human behavior, we can do things and just, you know, you've heard the expression, fake it till you make it. There are a growing body of scientific studies showing that the more we do that sort of thing, like if you don't feel confident, then go ahead and act confident. There are things you can do with your body language that shows confidence. Stand up, lean forward, put your hands on the table, and just continue talking in a nice, calm fashion. You will not only feel more confident, but everyone in the room will definitely respond to you. as though you have a tremendous amount of confidence. And that, there's just study after study after study showing that what we do can turn everything around. And thoughts are just another fashion of, you know, things that we do. So what you think is just as active as what you say, as what you physically do. And so there are a number of things that we can do that can change our circumstance. And some of the science I'm talking about is, I'm the only one doing it right now. I've been conducting surveys of people about these reality shifts. I conducted the first set of surveys 13 years ago, and I'm running a set right now. And what's interesting to me about, you know, people that are noticing reality shifting is that I'm seeing a change, an increase, actually, in some of the most commonly reported types of reality shifts. So we're seeing, it may not seem like that big a percentage, but in the last 10, 13 years, it's like 4% more people are noticing synchronicities than used to be the case. And it was a majority before, but it's going up. And so that's a sign to me that we're definitely in the midst of a pretty big shift of consciousness right now on this planet. So those are the kind of things I like to look at.
Let's talk about that little phrase right there, the shift of consciousness going on right now. What do you mean by that? What is shift in consciousness going on right now? Where is it? What was evidence? What will we see to know that that's something that's really happening?
Well, what I'm, like I said, I've been doing surveys with people. It was, the first group was people that received my newsletter, but I asked people, invited them to share the survey with everybody. They didn't have to believe that consciousness changes the physical world. I would be just as happy to get any kind of results at all from people who, you know, just would like to share their, you know, their experience. You know, have they noticed coincidence? Have they noticed synchronicities? And so the results that I got the first time I conducted this study were mind-boggling to me. I was really stunned because I found that 95% of the respondents were noticing coincidences and synchronicity in daily life. And 78% could find a parking place where and when they need it most. And 72% were noticing that keys and wallets and coats, they put things down in one place, and then they come back, and that item has, it's either completely gone or it's in some different place that they know they didn't put it, and nobody else could have moved it. And 86% of the people notice that time slows down, stops, or speeds up. Okay, these are pretty huge numbers. You know, this is much bigger than I thought it would be. And running the survey again now 13 years later, I'm finding that, if anything, the numbers are going up. We're seeing an increase in all these areas. So it's very interesting to me. Now, this is a survey of hundreds and hundreds of people, so there is statistical significance to it. And obviously, this is not something, you know, people may not want to talk about it. They might not feel like they can just go out and bend a spoon, for example. Back in 2000, only 8% of the respondents had ever bent a spoon, bent a key or a coin or anything like that without forcing the metal to bend.
Kind of like if you've ever had an accident, a car accident, it happens in slow motion when you're
right.
in it. Have you ever been in a car accident?
I have, yeah. Just small fender benders, really, but...
If you've been in a big... I've been in one before, and it's almost like when the accident was happening, everything went really slowly.
Right.
You know...
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what to say about it. It's almost like even though it happens in a split second, you have time to have complete thought patterns.
And something that yeah, exactly.
I
noticed that I wasn't in a car accident, but I was carrying my infant daughter in a train station in Switzerland. Actually, she was I had been carrying her, and then she got heavy, so I handed her to her father, and he put her up on his shoulders, and he had two suitcases, one in each hand. I was a little concerned about this, but my baby daughter was grabbing onto his hair, and, you know, she had her legs over his shoulders. And as he's striding along, she's bouncing up and down, kind of cooing, and she looks happy. And I think, well, looks possibly dangerous. I'll walk behind them. But the thing is, I also had suitcases, and I was carrying things, and I was too far behind to catch her when the unthinkable happened. And I could see that she had let go of his hair, and her back was arching, and her head was starting to go down, down, down toward the marble floor of the train station in Lausanne, Switzerland. I was horrified, you know, because it's like a hard marble floor. She's like 6 feet up in the air, about to do a head-first crash dive to that floor, and babies' heads are top-heavy. So this is what gets interesting. Right about at that point, everything did start slowing down, like what you're talking about. And thank goodness for that, because I had been way too far behind her to catch her. But thanks to the fact that everybody else was slowing down, I was like in some sort of bizarre movie where everybody else was going, ooh.
Exactly. That's exactly what
I was. I could hear the sound slowing down. So I could hear the what had been the high, you know, that high frequency click, click, click of women's high heels.
Uh-huh.
There are women in their high heels walking around. You know, these are fashionable women in Europe. So they're click-clacking around on the floor. But all of the sounds in the train station just went really low. So it wasn't just that I was seeing things slowing down. I was hearing them slow down.
So you're a physicist. What's happening?
It was the weirdest thing ever. I really don't know. I mean, if you say that we're quantum beings and that there are times that we can move into pure energy state, then I would tell you, Eva, that's what was happening to me, that I was there, but I was shifting my entire being more into pure energy so I could kind of go whoosh. And but to me, it seemed like it was normal. It feels normal to be pure energy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I still knew who I was. I still knew what I was going to do. I needed to catch my baby. It was unthinkable that she could hit the floor. That was not okay. Not okay at all.
And what to accomplish in that 1 second you would never be able to do.
Yeah, that's the freaky part. That's the freaky part. Somehow, I covered a distance of like 8 feet, you know, 2 meters, whatever. And suddenly, she's just easily, effortlessly landing in my arms, which was impossible. Because there's no way I could move that far that fast and be there in that split second. But it didn't, to me, it was very strange because I heard all the sounds slow down. So it looked like, from my point of view, I was just walking fast, yes. I'll grant you it was a fast walk, you know, almost a leap. But it wasn't anything, I mean, I didn't have to fly or anything. But if I was, if everybody else was going normal speed watching me, it must have looked like I flew. It must have looked like I just launched forward as a blur.
I bet it did, too. Or if they even saw you.
If anyone saw me, it would look like there I am, and then I sort of teleported, and now I'm over there. Like I covered a huge distance in a split second. There was no time, because she was, by the time I noticed there was a problem, she was at a 45-degree tilt, and just, you know, and she was being bounced on the shoulders. She was just about to take a complete head dive.
That's an amazing thing, isn't it?
It is so amazing.
To go back and watch that. So, and I'd like to talk about one other thing, how some people see things and some people don't. And I'll give you an example that happened to me just today. This morning I went somewhere where I've been no less probably than 30 or 40 times. And when I was coming back, I was kind of off in my mind somewhere while I was driving, just like I did the other night, you know, when I stood you up. And I thought that I was somewhere else.
Like literally.
And I was confused about where I was driving. I thought I'd made a wrong turn, but I thought that I'd made the right turn. And so if I had a been aware of what I was doing, I would have noticed that the landmarks weren't right. But because I thought I was somewhere else, the landmarks looked totally right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does make sense. That does happen. Well, so what's your question? Like what happens when
how do people see trees that aren't there? Or one person see a building and one person doesn't? Or
right.
One person see it red and one person see it blue? Does that really happen?
Oh, my gosh, it happens. I was talking to a friend of mine, and she had reported a story, a reality shift story, when she first moved to New York. She doesn't live there now, but she'd gone there to study nursing. And she had just been walking around, and she wanted to get a picture of an angel for her new apartment in New York. So she was so surprised to see this little flea market, and she moseyed through it and kind of, she saw a picture by an artist that was, I forget how much it cost. It was an angel, and she loved it, but she didn't have as much money as he wanted. Anyway, she showed, here's as much as I have in my wallet. And so he accepted the $26 instead of $45. She took the painting. She walked home, and she told her friend, like, you've got the best flea market here. I love it. And her friend said, flea market? What are you talking about? And she described it in detail and like, well, you know, there's this vendor and he sells pictures. And then her friend said, she said, Jen, we haven't had a flea market in New York at that location, you know, for at least 10 years. You know, like 10 years ago, maybe, but not now. It doesn't exist. And Jennifer was like, so she was really like, what? How can that be? So she went back to the same place she'd been, and it wasn't there. Totally like a Twilight Zone episode. But she knew she was there. She knew that it had been a huge flea market. She had been there. But she'd walked back 10 years in time.
So where did it come from?
This is not the only occurrence of someone walking back in time. What's happening is what I'm describing. These are what I would call reality shifts. And once again, what I believe is really occurring is that we're noticing quantum effects on the macro scale. So this it seems weird. It seems like that can't be happening. But what we need to rewrite our view of what we can expect to see in the material world, because this sort of thing does actually happen. And what's happening is time and space are linked in ways that we often don't really recognize. Think about the dream again. Like, let's go back to your son jumping out of that airplane, something he's never done, buying the football in Walmart. And the other example, what was that one? You had like three wonderful examples. Oh, the motorcycle. Okay, so whichever example you want to pick, what's going on there? We think, oh, that's just a dream, you know, just a dream. But sometimes that dream state is kind of like us going into that state of pure energy. Quantum particles are either in material form, where you can see them, or they're in a state of pure energy where they really can't be seen. They're just a waveform. And what I'm proposing is that our mindfulness, our consciousness, is capable of taking us to places and realities through that pure energy state, that we're still in our body, but like you said, it's kind of like he's not there, like I'm talking to Derek, but he's not really there. We all do that when we dream. We go somewhere else, and that place that we are when we're somewhere else is we're exploring the multiverse of possibilities, and time and space are wide open to us then. We can go anywhere. We can talk to our dead loved ones. We can travel the world and see people that we care about. We can even go to our own future.
We've only got about 3 minutes. So is there anything you want to talk about? If not, I'll ask you a question, but I want to give you the floor if there's anything you want to read.
I want to remind people. I'd love people that are interested in this. They can get my newsletter. It's free. It's at realityshifters.com. And you can like me on Facebook and Twitter, and I've got YouTube videos and lots of fun stuff at the website. And then the book is Reality Shifts that we're talking about. And maybe we've got time for your question, too.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know if you know Tom Campbell, that nuclear physicist that wrote that book, My Big Toe.
Yeah.
But he says, before you lucid dream, that you better make sure you don't have any fears, because you could just as easily get something fearful in a lucid dream as easily as you could get a good experience. Do you know about that?
Yeah, my first lucid dreams were nightmares. I write about it in my book, Reality Shifts, and that's how I learned how to do lucid dreaming. I kept waking up like 20 times a night, bothering my mother and father, and like, I'm having a nightmare. Boy, they got tired of that.
But
to me, it was real. I'd be starting to float up out of my body, and these little demon things would grab me by the feet, and it was a mess. So
now, that's what Eric did at the beginning. Now that I think about it, I never connected the dots till just now. But years ago, when he was like one or two, he would wake up screaming in the night, and you'd go in there. I'd go in there and try to wake him up. You could not wake him up. So I bet that's what was happening.
Probably.
And but he wouldn't remember the next day. He wouldn't have any idea what you were talking about.
Yeah. I had to learn. I had to go into those dreams and wake up in the dream and take it on and realize it's not just me against these nuisances, but I could call in some friends, you know, dream friends that would come and help me. That's what I started doing.
Great.
And, yep.
Interesting. Interesting thing. Okay, tell us one more time your website.
Okay, that's realityshifters.com. And that's the best way to contact me, by email, watch the videos on YouTube. They're right there on the website. And Facebook and Twitter, you can click right through and sign up for the newsletter. So I think people are going to love reading the stories about reality shifts, and I'd love to hear.
It's a wonderful book. It really is a wonderful book. And I have to tell you guys this, Cynthia Sue and I will be lecturing some together. We'll be in Seattle in November at the East West Bookstore. So look for us there if you live in the Seattle area. And Mountain View, California, but we don't know what date yet. So look for us. My website's evaher.com, and Cynthia Sue's is reality. What? Tell me exactly what it is.
Realityshifters.com.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, Cynthia Sue.
Thank you, Eva.
Have a good week. Good night.
You too.